as it might, won't it?
I feel like we're aware that it's a genocide. I mean, Israel have been, you know, giving carte blanche to level up Gaza. I mean, they act without impunity. And whilst this will, you know, make the world aware that this is in fact a genocide and they have committed war crimes, I don't think it will do much in the way of any justice or any ceasefire in sight for the Palestinians.
And Patricia, same question to you. We heard Netanyahu's comments on the ICJ ruling. We heard Ben-Gavir's comments, the so-called Minister of National Security, calling it anti-Semitic. They can't put this behind them. This is going to stick.
I think in terms of a shift in public opinion, that is the one thing that I think the ICJ succeeded in. In terms of abiding by international law, I think Israel in general has a very long track record of not abiding by international law. And you can see that from the clear dismissal of Israeli officials. So that's one of the issues with the Zionist entity. So we had a similar case when the West Bank, parts of Jerusalem were claimed to be Palestinian, and that when the court ruled that it's illegal to keep on building settlements in the West Bank. And that never stopped anybody. It never stopped American investors from investing. It did not stop the West Bank looking more and more like an extreme nightmare apartheid system. So they've never respected international law. You see them using white phosphorus all over the region. You see them carpet bombing, which is clearly against international law. Now they've also become... The ICJ has ruled that there is a case that can be made for genocide.
Is it that same disregard for international law and that sense of immunity provided by the likes of the United States that has allowed Israel to continue with the genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip, even in the wake of the ICJ ruling?
Definitely. It's been the backing of Western countries. So you see this gaslighting, even from the media. We've been talking about the genocide for the past couple of months, as anyone that has been a pro-Palestinian voice has. And you see journalists absolutely dismissing that and making it sound like we're saying something petty, we're being overly emotional at best. You see David Cameron make a statement.
The UK Foreign Secretary.
Yeah, the UK Foreign Secretary talk about essentially how Israel cannot commit a genocide because it's a democratic country. Absolute silly excuses that were being met with in
they're statements. Expelling a politician from the Knesset for supporting the ICJ ruling, speaking of democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's an apartheid terrorist regime, is what it is. And
does it, speaking of reporters and journalists, does it give you hope at all, or are you hopeful, that in the wake of the ICJ ruling, that these... the global media, so to speak, will start using the G word, the genocide word, that they've been dancing around?
I do not think so. I think despite the fact that we have enough proof of the war crimes, we've still not heard anything over the past couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
Any sort of real substantial criticism from mainstream media. There might be some changes in terms of more criticism towards the Zionist entity.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not think that that is going to be a statement that is going to be officially used.
All right, let me bring Natasha back in. We all know, Natasha, that there is a price to be paid for speaking out for Palestine, in other words, against apartheid Israel. What has been your experience with that?
I think people have always found the topic quite controversial, which I find shocking, considering that we're talking about ethnic cleansing and a categorical, genocide. As I said, I said without impunity. I meant they act with impunity. I mean, there seems to be no ramification or repercussion. There is no consideration to anything that predated October 7th, dating way back to the Nakba. I protested for Palestine. I don't know if you've seen the video that went viral. I was at a Labour conference and witnessed... a Palestinian man. He came just to challenge MPs and let them know that his family had been killed in Gaza. And he was met with blank stares and apathy. I mean, it was gut-wrenching grief. And this is the general attitude towards people of Palestine or anyone that protests in Palestine. You almost become a pariah in your community, in your workplace, for expressing any type of emotion. even though our country, our complicit.
How do you explain that deafness, that blindness on the part of the politicians here, for instance, as far as the Palestinian plight is concerned, that everybody has been seeing for more than 3 months now?
I think it's a lot to do with the propaganda we see in media and mainstream media. I think it's been really irresponsible coverage and obviously very pro-Zionist. And that's contributed a lot to the general public's perception of what's happening, even the language used and the dehumanization of the Palestinians.
That is for sure, Natasha. Moving on now, hot on the heels of the that ICJ ruling that said Israel had to do its utmost to limit death and destruction in Gaza and facilitate more humanitarian aid, at least 10 countries, including the U.S., suspended funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, also known as UNRWA, operating in the Gaza Strip. It came after the Israeli regime accused a number of agency staff of involvement in the October 7th Operation Al-Aqsa flood. Ireland and Norway have said suspending $666 million in aid is the wrong response. UNRWA, which has some 13,000 staff members in Gaza, expanded its operations during the Israeli bombardment and runs shelters that house hundreds of thousands of newly displaced people. Here is Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shteya appealing for the resumption of international aid that so many Palestinian lives depend on.
The accusations that Israel has made against certain staff of the UNRWA should have waited until investigation has come up with results. We were extremely shocked that certain number of countries have decided to suspend its aid or their aid for the UNRWA. The countries that have announced this suspension, their aid amounts to 70% of the annual budget of the United Nations Relief and Work Agency. This measure is extremely dangerous, and it is our hope that it will be reversed. The suspension of aid is in line with the Israeli plans for the forced evacuation of our people from Gaza into Egypt. The suspension of aid comes at the most difficult times, at a time when the International Court of Justice has called for an immediate supply and increase supplies and international aid into Gaza. UNRWA provide aid for 1.7 million Palestinians in Gaza.
Okay, let's discuss that with my guests. Patricia, I'll start with you. I got two questions for you. One is the timing of it all, as we heard the PM say, and as well as his comment there that this is a prelude to the Israeli regime trying to ethnically cleanse Palestinians, pushing them off the Gaza Strip altogether.
I think the timing makes sense, right? Because even most of the evidence that was presented to the ICJ was from UNRWA. It was mostly from UN institutions that are UN organizations that are working within the Gaza Strip. Yeah. So it does make sense. It seems like international law actually has become something of a joke. International organizations have become something of a joke where America can just come in and do whatever it pleases. Yeah. It can cut off funding and punish people with sanctions. Even as we can see now, UN organizations, anything to support its own interests in exactly whatever region they please to interfere in. So I think that's something that sadly is expected. It's not something that shocks us anymore. And I think as a Lebanese citizen and someone who's from the Middle East, I do not think that it's shocking that international law has once again failed the people of the Middle East.
And do you agree with the Prime Minister there, as many I think would, that this is a prelude, a precursor to Israel trying to ethnically cleanse the Gaza Strip altogether?
Absolutely. I think from day one that was something that was clear. From the pressure that was exerted onto the Egyptian government to take on refugees, the EU offered, it's reported that the EU offered money, aid so that they could take them in. This was something that was absolutely, there are leaked documents from Netanyahu's office talking about this matter. And it's not something that the Zionist entity has not done before. Yes. It's quite clear. Even in the statements of politicians, in their genocidal statements, they want to get rid of Palestinians. They see Palestinians as a plague. to their land that they're entitled to. So exactly. It absolutely makes...
Let me put this question to Natasha as well. How do you see this? This is obviously collective punishment at a time when there is a looming humanitarian catastrophe. 1.8 million displaced Palestinians, a lot of them at risk of experiencing famine, and yet more than 10 countries withdraw funding from a UN agency whose presence in the Gaza Strip is so critical at such a critical time.
It's absolutely disgusting. Obviously, the intent there is to kind of penalise anybody that should expose the truth, which has always been Israel's tactics, and should anyone else be deemed to be complicit in that, then they too take the same sort of action. It's just disgusting what we see, you know, from, you know, aerial bombardment, relentless missiles, the chemical weapons, and our people are just dying of just common colds and starvation. They put an embargo on insulin for children. I mean, the depravity is just nauseating. And I think we're all aware of their ethnic cleansing agenda, and I don't think they take much effort into concealing that, to be honest.
Exactly. Now, let me take a moment to remind our viewers that you're watching Gaza Under Attack with me, Saeed Pourreza, where we shine a spotlight on the ongoing U.S.-Israeli carnage in the Gaza Strip. As we discussed previously, several Western countries have halted their support of Gaza's largest aid agency, a move that could threaten the lives of Gazans who currently depend on humanitarian assistance. Have neighboring Muslim nations done enough to assist their Palestinian brothers and sisters? We asked Parveen Hossein, a Muslim mother in London, for her thoughts.
The Muslim nations, well, I think it's a travesty to call them Muslims in the first place, because if they were true Muslims, they would look out for the Ummah. They are not Muslims in the first place. They are just stooges of the West. They're installed in these countries by the West to meet its own agenda, and they are very narrow-minded. They are looking at their own monetary, economic, the so-called economic interest. They want to have trading relationships with Israel, criminal entity, the occupying people, Saudi Arabia, leads all the rest, and all the Gulf countries are together in this. So they just want to make a quick profit from this, to normalize relationships with someone like Israel, to let the Palestinian cause just be forgotten, and that tyrant Netanyahu showed the map without the presence of Palestine, and Israel has these notions where with a greater Israel, so it will not stop. It's a monster. It's a monster which needs to be checked. It wants to invade, go into Lebanon. It wants to just swallow up everything with the aid of the Western superpowers.
Parveen also told us that the people of those countries are fed up with their own governments.
The masses are totally against their own rulers, but they have been oppressed tyrannically, and they are imprisoned, they are beheaded, they are put their uprising is put down, but it will come to bite them. It may not happen in the next decade, or it will happen in 20 years' time, but it is the pathways have been set for general masses to rise up. And if you look at what's happening to the common people in America, even though they are not from the Ummah, but they are human, as a human being, you would rise up against this atrocity, this oppression. So the Muslims in these countries are going to rise up sooner or later. They can't kill off the entire population.
The genocidal war on Gaza has been the deadliest for media workers ever recorded. 120 journalists killed in less than 4 months, a number that dwarfs the figure from the Vietnam War and World War II, 63 and 67 respectively. To commemorate the fallen, South Africa-based journalists and pro-Palestinian demonstrators have held a vigil in Johannesburg to honor those targeted and killed by apartheid Israel in Gaza.
none of us here are actually telling the Palestinian stories because we can't. We are too far away. We are relying on our colleagues in Gaza and our colleagues closer to the conflict to tell that story. What we can do is support the endeavor. What we can do is ensure that the language we use in the telling of the story by our newsrooms is accurate, and that we stand in solidarity when they are targeted. That's what we can do.
All right, let's continue the conversation with my guests, Patricia Taleb and Natasha Khan. Natasha, the deliberate killing of the voices bringing us the stories from the ground can only mean you're hiding something.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, rather than going for, initially they went with the narrative of trying to get all Hamas fighters, and we've seen time and time again them targeting non-combatants, women and children, and these are oftentimes brushed over. We saw them not only killing their own, showing the global sign of peace, the white flag of surrender. And they did it to ours as well, which was caught in as mainstream media. Again, they tried to question the journalistic integrity of these people because when truth is exposed, they panic. But they've made no secret of it. The idea is to make the strip entirely uninhabitable, not only in terms of the environment, but getting rid of those of professions, those that can expose the truth, those that can offer medical support, those that can educate. The idea is to make it so it's just hell on earth for those that remain. And it's despicable. I listen to these things and I can't believe this is the world we live in.
It is unbelievable indeed. Patricia, so if you're a journalist in the Gaza Strip, you're targeted and murdered by an apartheid regime, aided and abetted by its Western backers. And if you're a journalist outside of the Gaza Strip in the Western world and challenge the status quo or the Israeli narrative, you run the risk of losing your job. And this happened in the UK. For example, an attempt by the former Israeli ambassador to the UN and a Nakba advocate by the name of Danny Danan, who has tried to get a journalist on Britain's Sky News fired simply for challenging his remarks about Gaza. How do we explain that? How do we wrap our minds around something like that?
I think the issue with the Zionist entity is that it's announced a war on truth, because the very act of showing what is happening in Gaza, the very act of showing the truth of the atrocities that they're committing, in itself changes international opinion. And this is something that we've seen now with that ability that we've had through social media to be able to hear the Palestinian voices on the ground without much need for media as the middleman anymore.
And also there's the complicity of the pro-Israel media or Western media who have traditionally beaten the drums of war, as in the case of Afghanistan, of Iraq, of Libya, elsewhere, and now against the Palestinian people.
I think that's something that, especially in the West, has this propagation that there's a neutral way of presenting. There's a way that you can actually present things in an unprejudiced way. This parading of neutrality that Western media claims has fallen short time and time and time again when covering especially the issues of the Middle East, and especially issues where America has benefits and special interests in. And that's primarily because you see media conglomerates are very much dominated by the same people. Mm-hmm. And they all have and push the same political agenda. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those situations where the very act of showing the atrocities that are committed by the United States and by the Zionist entity or by the United States in the war in Afghanistan are going to actually change public opinion to the point where they would not be able to commit those atrocities. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's a lot of sense that there's a lot of sense. Yeah.
Natasha, I want you to talk about the following, and I'll use the UK as an example. On the one hand, the UK contributes with aid to the Gaza Strip at a time like this, and probably has before October. And then on the other hand, it helps Israel militarily, diplomatically, in every possible way. We saw the Prime Minister go there, stand by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and say he hoped that he would win. I wonder what winning meant to him. And the UK being home to Israeli weapons manufacturers, all kinds of support. So on the one hand, aid to the Palestinians, but on the other, enabling the Palestinian oppressors to carry on with their oppression. How do we explain that?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think the West have always had an alternative agenda for the existence of Israel. I mean, as we all know, Zionism was founded.
I think we have temporarily lost Natasha. Maybe I can put the same question to you, Patricia. So as I say, humanitarian on the one hand, as we saw in the case of Yemen, for example, selling billions of pounds or dollars worth of weaponry to Saudi Arabia, and then being the bigger donor of humanitarian aid to Yemen. Here as well, how can they do this and get away with it?
I think this is something that also has to do with marketing. American politicians have been talking in this manner, in particular, all over the Middle East. I remember a few years ago there was this instance even of the American ambassador that had gone on national TV, even though she's a diplomat, that's a foreign diplomat, she's not allowed to interfere in internal issues.
Yeah.
And she'd come out and she started with the claims of we're actually the biggest donors of Lebanon, while they've been spending millions funding the IOF, and at the same time will only fund the Lebanese army with a couple thousand dollars per year. Yeah. So there's this absolutely disproportionate way of presenting things. They come in and they say that they're the biggest donors of humanitarian aid, whilst also funding the very same atrocities that are going to require humanitarian aid to begin with.
Exactly.
Okay,
all right. We're fresh out of time, though, right?
Yay.
On time. Thank you very much. Patricia Taleb, Natasha Khan, if she's still with us. If not, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking to both of you. And thank you. Gaza Under Attack, we'll be back with more. Until then, keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ يُوهُ بِلِيهِ اسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. I want to go back tonight to the topic that we had started a week ago, 2 weeks ago, and that is the topic of shaitan. The aim for today, and inshallah in the next lecture that we'll have next Wednesday, is to look at some of the tricks that shaitan uses. Shaitan has a very keen interest in creating animosity and fights between family members and between believers. Yeah, the fact is, right, like, we're all going to annoy each other at times, for sure. Yeah, like, because we're all individuals, right? So maybe God doesn't want me to say that. I don't know, sometimes the way people walk may annoy us. Sometimes the way people talk may annoy us, right? Sometimes the way people do zikr may annoy us, whatever. Yeah, of course. But then what happens is that this thought goes into my head is that, man, that's annoying. And then instead of just saying, but that's life, because it is life, people will annoy us. What begins to happen is I begin to reflect on that. Yeah, this guy always does that, right? And now I've picked a fight with that guy in my brain when in reality there is no fight between us. And so the next time I see you, I resent you already. And now every time you do that, I resent you even more, right? And subhanAllah, like I go to bed mad at that guy when there's nothing wrong, right? But shaitan just planted the seed, right? And shaitan just said, yeah, but you don't like that, do you? And he does it, she does it, right? And so now every time that person messages you, it bugs you. Every time that person reaches out, it bugs you. And they want to borrow something, it bugs you. And you see that this rancor between believers is created when we can easily say, no, I'm not going to follow through with it, right? I'm just going to leave it out. He's a believer, she's a believer, and she's a human being who's prone to making mistakes. No one's perfect, you know? I think the moment we realize that we're not perfect, no one else is perfect, that imperfection is where we live and where we can survive happily with each other, right? We accept each other's imperfections. But the trick that shaitan does is that he just makes us cultivate these animosities, these fake animosities with people. And then eventually it begins to translate into action. So a cold shoulder where I won't reply a salam back to you, right? Or an email or a text message that's a bit rough or whatever, is because I'm cultivating this hatred that shaitan has planted in my head for each other in real life. And the fact is that these are like innocent things. But how many examples do we have in our world of people who financially hurt other people because of a hatred that they have for them? My God, I have tons of examples, right? Physically hurt each other because of the hatred that they have for a certain group of people. You look at warfare and tribal warfare, hell, there's no reality to it. It's just one tribe doesn't like another tribe, and so they fight, they hate each other, right? But this is again a trick of shaitan. When you look at the Quran, like it's a very beautiful verse. If you look at Surah Yusuf, verse number 100, like this is the end of Surah Yusuf. So now Yusuf is the governor already in Egypt, or the head of the treasury in Egypt, and his father and his brothers and his mother, they all come. And then Allah says, وَرَفَعَ أَبَوَيْهِ عَلَى الْأَرْشِ وَخَرُّ لَهُ سُجَّدًا. He raises his parents upon the throne and everyone does sajda. And he says, يَا أَبَتِ هَذَا تَعْوِيلُ رُؤْيَايَ مِنْ قَبْلِ. Remember in the very beginning of Surah Yusuf, he saw a dream of the sun and the stars doing sajda. And so he said, Ya Allah, O Father, this is the ta'wil. This is the interpretation of that original sajda I saw. And then he begins to thank Allah. Yeah, قَدْ جَعَلَنَا رَبِّي حَقًّا. And then he says, وَقَدْ أَحْسَنَ بِي. Allah has been good to me. إِذْ أَخْرَجَنِي مِنَ السِّجْنِ. When he took me out of prison. وَجَاءَ بِكُم مِنَ الْبَدْوِ. And he brought you from the desert to me. مِنْ بَعْدِ. Look at what he says. مِنْ بَعْدِ أَنْ نَزَغَ الشَّيْطَانِ بَيْنِي وَبَيْنَ إِخْوَتِي. Like he saved us when shaitan tricked and harmed me and my brother's relationships. Yeah? SubhanAllah, look at the wisdom of Yusuf. It was his brothers who plotted to kill him. It was his brothers who threw him in the well. It was his brothers who did all of these things. But he didn't say, remember, like after my brothers did this, after shaitan made my brothers do this. Because it's shaitan that causes enmity between us. We have to realize that. Next time, I'm telling you, next time you feel this rancor in your heart for somebody, and we all do, time and time again, we will for sure, because that's just how shaitan tricks, right? Next time we feel that, just ask Allah's protection from shaitan, because it's shaitan who is bothering us. So that's the second trick of creating animosity. The third trick, and we'll end with this, is that one of the really effective tricks of shaitan is through distraction and wasting time. Yeah? Shaitan is a master of this, right? I've mentioned this book to you before. I mentioned it at JCC last week. It's a book by C.S. Lewis. I know I talked about it, I think, a few years ago or a year ago. C.S. Lewis is the author of Chronicles of Narnia, right? He was a Christian theologian. And so a lot of his books have Christian theology throughout it. He's written a book, and you can Google this, you can find a PDF. I think it's one of the more interesting secular books I've read. It's called Screwtape Letters. Screwtape Letters. And Screwtape Letters is basically a conversation between an older shaitan and a younger shaitan. A young, older devil, a more experienced devil, and a younger devil. And so the older devil is giving the younger devil tricks of the trade, basically, how to trick people, right? And one of the main tricks the devil, he says, uses, but you see this in life, is distraction, right? So shaitan knows that he cannot win a debate against God's angels because God is Haq. And so Iblis has no power to convince us through argument that God doesn't exist. There's no capability of him to do that. And so what he will do is he will just distract us. So the moment we start thinking about God, he will distract us. And all he wants to do is win the distraction battle, right? And so you see this all the time, right? Like it's time for salah, and you'll see your light flash on your phone. And you're like, oh, let me check my phone really quick. Oh, it's a message. Let me just write a quick reply back. 10-second reply. And he won. He already won. It was time for salah. He made you distracted. Even if that distraction was for a minute, that's all he wanted. Because now you picked a phone call or a message above God. Shaitan won. He says, I won this round. Round two tomorrow. Yeah? He distracts. You go to the bathroom to do wudu. You get distracted by the mirror and you look at yourself. And so you pause and you fix your hair and you know, 30-second distraction, shaitan won, right? You're in the bathroom, you want to finish quickly, and you think of this obscure thing to Google on your phone while you're sitting on the toilet. You never even thought of that otherwise, but you do it on the toilet. Why? Because he just wants to keep you there a bit longer. Shaitan won. That's all he wants to do. Like, we think shaitan wants to win this long game battle. No, shaitan wants to win round by round. 30-second delay from remembering God, shaitan won that round. Yeah? And so think of that, right? Because shaitan's ultimate goal is distraction, right? Distraction, distraction. And the quicker he can distract us, and the more rounds he wins, eventually, the delay in my prayer, the delay in doing something good will not seem so bothersome to me anymore. So I'll just be like, ah, 5 more minutes, what's the big deal? I'm going to pray. 10 more minutes, I'm going to pray, right? And because of that distraction, shaitan, you find win in so many different battles.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you.
Because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I'm Umay Biha Mukhtar, your host on IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. Joining us today is Sister Salma Khalfan, a respected Islamic researcher, and she will enlighten us on the concept of hijab as guided by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
What are his evidence, Ayatollah Khamenei's views of why the hijab is made compulsory in the Iranian society?
Actually, when we say Iranian society, we mean Islamic society.
Okay.
Because the Iranian now society is not just the old-time Irani Mastani system. It's a revolution that was created based on the Islamic system that Imam Khomeini rose up to want to prepare for the reappearance of Imam Zamana, that this nation should at least be a step forward to show their diligence, that they are going, they are practicing the Islamic rule that Imam Zamana wants to lay in its all perfection.
True.
So it's a starting point, right? So it's not only the Iranian society. It's Iran wants all based on Islam and its principles. And that also principles that I got from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentioned in what? Quran and Ahadith. You see, the West, Ayatollah Khamenei says that the West, this unbound relation between men and women are very common. So absence of a modest clothing, you know, or a mediator is normal for them. So he says, I don't mean to say that in Western countries all men and women are corrupt. No. You see, he's talking with justice here, Ayatollah Khamenei. He's just saying that everything is wrong. All of you are like that. No. I won't make such accusations, he said. And this is not true, of course. Surely, there are also chaste good men and women among them, the righteous people with virtues. So usually, you know, when Ayatollah Khamenei speaks about this, it's mostly based on what the people, the government does. Yeah. It's not the people, you see. So he wants to say, that reiterate that there are good people, there are virtuous people. Mainly people, they want to be good, you know. They want a change in their lives.
That's why he had written that whole letter for you to the youth of the West. And he had written such beautiful things. Just to show that he also is thinking about them. They're important for
him. Yeah,
they're
important for them. It's like they're also his children.
Yeah.
You know? However, he says, the sexual freedom dominates Western societies, unfortunately. This is mixing of men and women. And it's a major part of Western culture. You know?
Yeah.
The major part that this is very considered, very like stylish, very, you know, smart and very sophisticated. In Western culture, freedom of sexual desire is permitted. And in some cases, unfortunately, unlimited. Why? Because they have the audacity and the, you know, permission to also build buildings like where there are things going on that are so, you know, filled with vulgar things like discos.
Yeah.
You know, alcoholic drinks.
Casinos.
Yeah.
All things to kind of, you know, take you away from what
to just drive your akal down.
And that's how, like, I think we had mentioned once in one of these episodes that this is how they control the society. This is how, you know, they don't let them go further in terms of their spirituality. Yeah. This all is kind of a blockage, yeah?
Yeah.
So, inshallah. So, let's just take a brief intermission and we'll be back. So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and we've been discussing about what Ayatollah Khamenei's views of the hijab is. And you told us that, in fact, this was not the Iranian society as such. We're talking about the Islamic society. The Iranian society is now the Islamic society, which, in fact, we should be proud of, you know.
Yeah.
And we have been discussing about how the Western ideologies kind of come and limit this progress, especially in terms of our spirituality.
Yeah. He first discusses about how the Western has no limitations between the men and women and allows freely mixing. So he says that some Western countries are so deeply submerged in this area of this freedom between men and women and this deviance, and they've transformed their lives in such embarrassing ways. If you go and see now, it's been institutionalized, you know, like gay and lesbianism. It's all like LGBT and everything is so institutionalized that they find, you know, and if you go and see even there, people find it still strange. The people who are, you know, like they have good morals, their hearts are pure, even if they're Christians, and they believe in proper marriage of man and woman, but they find it too strange that why is this happening? And somehow you see a distance when you see, you know, their children getting involved in such nonsense. Yeah. So there are so embarrassing ways for them also.
And also the irony that that is, you know, that is okay for us to include and be inclusive to such kind of groups of people, but it's so hard for them to be inclusive to women with hijab.
Yes.
So it's very unfortunate.
Yeah, very unfortunate. And of course, they later regret it. This is what Ayatollah Khamenei says. This is something that Western thinkers, politicians, and policymakers cannot resolve. How they cannot resolve? That means they're seeing that such things are giving rise to corruption, embarrassment, diseases. It's that they feel like, what do they do? The youth want it. Why? It's because of their wrong policies. What are these wrong policies based on? They are based on un-Islamic principles. True. And based on their own cultures and biased views. Okay? So they cannot resolve now the policymakers, and it has become a big problem for themselves. The West also exported this culture, behavior, and a harmful habit to all the countries, Ayatollah Khamenei says. This corruption did not exist in other countries first. In Muslim countries, even in non-Muslim Eastern countries, such things like this freedom of mixing gatherings, like sexual freedom, did not exist. It was just imported from the West. If you go see Indians, okay, Indians were very respectful first.
Yeah.
Although they were Hindus, they were not Islamic, they did have Islam, but they had that shame. But now if you go and see, that shame has gone away, importing the Western ideas. So they exported these ideas, those people, ignorant people, took the ideas with both hands. Why? Puppets.
Yeah, very true. We're just going to go on a short break and we'll be back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we were discussing Ayatollah Khamenei's views of the hijab and why it's made compulsory on the Iranian society. And we were discussing about how the Western ideologies are kind of so corrupt, and we are kind of looking at them as the ideal to follow. But they have brought in homosexuality and, you know, this free mixing, while in the past we had so much piety, purity, and, you know, they were shameful. They didn't like showing off their bodies. But now, because everyone's trying to adopt the Western culture that seems the most appropriate, we all want to be like them for some reason, which is unfortunate.
He was also saying about how these things did not exist and they were imported, you know, from the West. So they did not exist. There were a lot of, you know, like modesty in their natures, like some nations, there was a lot of modesty in them. But now, what with this influence, you know, of the West, they even got this in their culture. So now Ayatollah Khamenei says, who stood up? See, he's proud of, you know, former you know, Islamic leader also. Who stood up? The Islamic revolution and revolutionary leader, Imam Khomeini, resisted this corruption. and announced from its beginning. That's very important.
Yeah.
That he did not accept this unbound relations between men and women. It believes in the necessity of a modest appearance and Islamic-based relations between men and women. The Islamic Republic insisted on this way of life. Some people think that this is an unimportant, trivial issue.
True.
But they are at best wrong. This is an important, extremely important, that too, a matter. Then he says, I should tell you here that one of the main reasons for Western animosity towards the Islamic revolution has to do with this matter, that is the hijab, unlimited sexual behavior. We don't allow it, they allow it.
Yeah.
They feel, you know, what is wrong with it?
Yeah.
Why are these people resisting? Then he says, they are extremely defensive over this issue. If the Islamic Republic had been less strict solely on this matter of hijab, probably, you know, allowing it or not allowing it or being loose the way they are, and had allowed the Western culture of unbound immorality regarding unhealthy relations of men and women to appear in our society, much opposition from political and non-political spheres in the West would have diminished.
Yeah,
they would have said, okay, now at least they've adopted this idea, leave them alone, you know?
Yeah.
But they are like, what's wrong? And why are these people progressing, yet they are doing this? They just like, I feel they are very jealous. They're very jealous.
Yeah.
Or they have been totally obliterated it.
True. I feel like this is kind of making someone realize that you don't need all of this to survive. I remember when we used to see, you know, movies, or when we used to see some documentaries, and they talk about these people who have been, you know, wasting their time by and going to get drunk, and, you know, after a hard day's work, they go straight to the pub or something. They just, or they go and watch immoral things. Right now, the Pornhub is like, you feel so
commercialized.
Worried, so commercialized, and it's one of the biggest industries right now. So it's very scary. And they feel like, how is it possible that this country is going on without all these distractions? We don't need to, you know, to detoxify ourselves and go home and go get a drink. But they need that to survive. Yeah. So it's very interesting how we work so differently and we are yet thriving successful, you know.
Yeah.
So it's very beautiful. Alhamdulillah.
So then he says that, you see, in our country, once the removal of headscarves became obligatory, but no one in the world objected the compulsory removal of hijab. Okay?
Yeah.
In our neighboring country, Turkey, removal of hijab became compulsory. And even until recently, some Turkish governments continued this obligation, as we witnessed examples during the recent years. But nobody on the planet ever objected this move.
Yeah.
So they made it compulsory to remove. We made it compulsory to wear. Again, he says.
Yeah.
More striking than that is what happens in some European countries, which consider themselves as advanced, so-called advanced. Though human rights and public opinion are presented as important in their propagations and claims, in France, human rights are important, yeah. He says. But in France, girls are not allowed to go to human rights here, you see? In France, girls are not allowed to go to school whilst wearing headscarves. So why? Where is the freedom there, yeah?
True, yeah.
In this case, compulsion, that is force, is permissible for them.
Yeah.
And they see nothing wrong with it. However, they object the fact that the Islamic Republic has made a modest dress compulsory. So what is the difference, yeah? If there's a problem with forcing women to appear in society with a specific type of clothing, it's worse than compulsory hijab, because wearing hijab is closer to well-being. At least these two obligations must be viewed with equal judgment, he says. But the West does not present this perspective. He says that, no, we have forced, it's okay, but you shouldn't force. You see?
Yeah.
So at least they should view it as with justice, yeah? If
true.
They think that, okay, freedom of rights, they make the policies, so...
Yeah, and I think people have this kind of idea in their mind that, you know, Iran is so oppressive and, oh my God, the people of Iran, what are they going through? And those people haven't really even come into Iran to see the situation. They're just seeing based on what the social media is kind of presenting to them. So we were just hearing a lecture a while ago by the speaker who is a German, and he lived in the US, and he's come here as a professor, he's a Shia, and he said that his parents were very against him becoming Shia, especially and going to Iran. But he was trying to explain them, but they weren't like understanding, and then they accepted it. But he said the time his mother really accepted it was when she came to Iran and said, oh, I didn't know that the people of Iran were actually living normal lives. We thought they were all oppressed. We thought you are getting oppressed as well. You're being brainwashed. She said that now I understand that they're living like normal people. They're living
and the
normal
women
lives.
Too, with the hijab, they're living completely normal lives and enjoying, right?
Yeah, it's very beautiful. Alhamdulillah. So thank you so much for your valuable time and your beautiful points. And we hope to see you, inshallah, in the next episode.
Inshallah.
Inshallah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Welcome everyone to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today it's my pleasure to welcome to this program Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Stay tuned.
Sheikh Ibrahim Yaqub Zakzaki is a prominent Muslim scholar and a leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. In the 1970s, during the peak of communist activism on university campuses around the world, he proposed a different path as an activist. And that is Islam, which he said could be the path forward for all aspects of life. He founded the Islamic movement in Nigeria in the 1980s while still at the university. It was a small grassroots movement. However, the organization has now grown to have millions of followers. Some estimates state that as many as 20 million people are part of the Islamic movement in Nigeria now. Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki says that his movement has been successful because its main message has been one of fighting oppression and having sovereignty over one's own land and resources.
Thank you so much for joining me today on Hidden Files, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. I'd like you to give us some short points about the highlights of your life that got you from being a college student or a young student to then the leader of the Islamic movement of Nigeria.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina Muhammad wa ala tayyibina tahirin ma'asum. Personally, I don't like to speak about myself. I would prefer that others speak on my own.
But who better to speak about what you've done?
Well, presently, I'm 70 years old. I was born May 1953. Early life was studied in local Islamic schools, according to traditional way. My father was a Quranic teacher, so I started learning from him. Learning from rudimentary up to the level of memorizing some parts, and then he delivered me to another Quranic school. Then we have what we call, after Quranic school, we start what we call book school. That's why I start learning from book. It includes all different subjects in Islam, ranging from Tawheed, theology, fiqh, jurisprudence, Luga, that's language, literature, and so many other subjects. All the books are in Arabic. You will read it in Arabic, and there will be translation in a local language and explanation in local language.
So you were always interested in Islamic studies?
Traditionally, that's what we are doing. And I attended different schools from different sheikhs, because normally at one time these schools do not look like the Hausa, you know. We used to study from the houses of the sheikhs. They have school, but the teacher would be only one, teaching different subjects from the beginning to up toward a certain level. So normally you change from one teacher to another. You learn, pick from one, you go for another to forward. Literature, you go for to another for other subjects. That's what we used to. So by sometime in 1969, I was 16 then, I started what you might be called formal education. There was a school called School for Provincial Arabic School. This is a place where the then local authority was teaching, training those who will teach in the primary school, who will teach Arabic and Islamic studies. So I was there for about 2 years, 69, 70. There were 71 to 75, I was in a college in a different city. Formerly, I was born in Zaria, that's why I started studying. And I went to a provincial Arabic school for Arabic studies in Kano. Okay, the School of Arabic Studies in Kano has two sections. One is called grade two teachers, Kismar Ma'alimi, the teacher section in Arabic. And the other one is called higher Muslim studies. This is mostly is in Arabic only. But the other one, one will study also in English language. This is like any other secondary, English language, mathematics, geography, history, all in English language.
Right.
In addition, there will be Arabic and Islamic studies, but it is like any other college. The only addition is that it's Arabic language, which is compulsory, and the Islamic studies, which is also compulsory. All right.
So out of all of your studies, what was key, you think, in creating the Sheikh Zak Zaki that we know today?
At that time, I was just been trained as a teacher, for example. After I finished school in 1975, I started as a teacher. But during my study in those 5 years, I was also interested in subjects that were not being taught in the school. So I started privately to study them. This included government, economics, and
that was key.
I was interested in 1974, I sat for examination ordinary level of in those subjects. And in 75, after finishing school, as a trained teacher for primary school, successful training. So I also, at the same year, sat for advanced level in 4 different subjects. That's the maximum advanced level one can take. That would include government, economics, Islamic studies, and I think Hausa language. That's the maximum. I also studied Islamic history advanced level, but I did not write the examination. So success in those two examinations qualified me to start a degree course IR later, in 76. Mm-hmm. So from 76 to 79, I was studying BSc Economics in a famous university in my own hometown,
Right.
So those 70s, late 70s, in the university, it was ideological conflict. There were communists. Many of the teachers, particularly in the Faculty of Social Sciences, were communists.
There was a lot going on in the world in the 70s.
And then there were people who were divided into three. There was people who were satisfied with the status quo. Mostly Christians, because Christians are not advocating anything. And then there was those who think that there should be change, but that should be in form of communism. And then there are few of us who felt that Islam was also an ideology which can also be used to establish a society and the social justice the communists are calling, but it will be found in Islam.
Well, let me just stop you there, because especially in the 70s, that was the time of communists, as you said, socialist movements. Mm-hmm. And we know that we hadn't had, like, a successful Islamic state. So, but you had studied economics and other aspects, jurisprudence. What made you think that could be key to solving a lot of the problems that people were going through?
I have a background of Islamic studies. I have studied Islam a lot. All what they traditionally used to learn in those years, and in that time, I have always studied it. And those who are calling for communism, they are calling for social justice, but they have problem with religion. They equate Islam with Christianity. They think that whatever happened in